According to the CDC, at least 30,000 cases of Lyme disease are reported by state health departments and the District of Columbia each year. And unfortunately, the idea of a tick season is sort of a thing of the past. We don't really have tick seasons anymore. We just have ticks all throughout the year, especially in the Northeast, right here in Connecticut. We deal with tick populations all throughout the calendar year. The winter does not kill them off because it just doesn't get cold enough for a long period of time. So even right now in February, ticks are out and you need to be aware of them. And so this is something we've definitely learned and made a priority of by partnering up with Partner in Lyme. It is a local nonprofit, and this organization tries to help with the burden that so many people carry, especially financial burden, when it comes to Lyme disease. They provide $1,000 in financial assistance to residents of Connecticut diagnosed with tick-borne diseases, like Lyme disease, of course. So joining us back on the show is the founder and executive director of Partner in Lyme, and that's Jessica Schneider. And I always love when Jessica comes on the show with such important information that really does impact each and every person who wants to go outdoors here in Connecticut. Jessica, welcome back to the show. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm doing fine, thank you. You know, it's interesting. You and I had discussed having you come on, a few weeks ago, because we want to talk about something that's going to be coming up with your nonprofit. So we had planned having you come on the show weeks ago. But it's interesting, this past weekend, we finally have sunshine, right? Everybody's out enjoying it. We go for a hike on Saturday, and I come home, and I say to my husband and my son, all right, guys, take all the clothes off, put it in the dryer. We got to put it on the warm cycle, you know, kill any potential ticks. We got to do tick checks. I'll see you guys in the up in the bathroom. My husband and my son looked at me like I had six heads. They're like, what are you talking about? What? It's February. I said, guys, you're clearly not listening to my show, because you would know that we are not in tick seasons anymore, guys. We have ticks all throughout the year. So it's perfect timing for you to come on, especially because I did see a lot of people out this weekend with the nice weather.
And I did get a call this weekend from somebody who had an embedded tick this weekend.
There you go.
So you're absolutely correct. Take those precautions. It's worth the time and the effort just to save yourself the aggravation and the testing and the possible infection that can come. So year round in Connecticut, it's something we really do need to be vigilant about.
And it's been that way, right, Jessica? I mean, we've been sort of living in this new world where ticks are prevalent all throughout the year. I mean, it's been several years, right, that we haven't really had a tick season per se?
It has. We need a hard, deep freeze. And it can't just be under 35 degrees for 2 or 3 days. It has to be a significant period of time and a deep freeze. And we just don't get that anymore. So we're living in these moderate winter temperatures, and anything above 35 degrees, the deer ticks are active. Not as active, of course, as in the summer, but still out and still looking to feed and are still a potential carrier of infection for us.
So it is really important that if you're going to be out and about for any reason, even if you're somebody who's out skiing, like, again, I look at even the nice conditions when you're out skiing, it's still warm enough that ticks could, you know, can very much be. I mean, they're not out in full force like we see in the warmer months, but they are out. So you got to check the clothing. Also, if you've got animals, got to do the tick checks on animals, make sure they're staying up on their medications to prevent any kind of tick illnesses as well. What's interesting is today we're really going to focus on something that you and your team at Partner in Lyme, you've noticed, the connection between mental health and tick-borne diseases. Apparently, medical journal studies have shown that there is a strong connection between the two. What have you learned?
Very strong. And it's something that I see and I hear daily in my conversations with people in our community. And one thing that's worth noting is in your introduction, the CDC has revised, they've made an addendum to the statistics. While they're saying about 30,000 people are infected each year, they have gone on record saying that it's approximately 10 times that amount that are not reported. So just alone in Connecticut, we anticipate 30,000 new cases in Connecticut alone.
Wow.
And so when you compare that number to other diseases, you know, such as breast cancer, they receive about 3,600 new diagnoses a year. and we look at all the awareness and the funding and the support that goes into some of other diseases, we have to ask ourselves, why are we not focusing on Lyme disease, on tick-borne disease? Because it's a pandemic that no one's talking about, and Connecticut is an endemic area. So it's because it has such strong roots to the mental health crisis, it's a really important conversation to have. And I'm really grateful that you invited me back on to start that conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, if you're just tuning in, we're talking to Jessica Schneider, who is the founder and executive director of Partner in Lyme Incorporated, which is a 501c3 nonprofit. It's an organization based right here in Connecticut. And the reason it's here is to help for people who have financial burdens dealing with a Lyme disease diagnosis. They provide $1,000 in financial assistance to residents of Connecticut diagnosed with the tick-borne disease. And of course, you can find out more about what they do at partnerinlyme.org. You know, ever since learning, Jessica, that there is a connection between mental health disorders and Lyme disease, what is something that your nonprofit has specifically been doing to fill that gap?
We host monthly meetups in coffee shops, local independent coffee shops around the state, because we realized during COVID that people need to gather. You need to have support when you're going through any chronic condition. But with Lyme, people think that it's just a rash, maybe a swollen knee, maybe some fatigue, and you take doxycycline and you're better. But unfortunately, for a large segment of the people who are infected with Lyme, they don't get better after that initial course of antibiotics. And they're really struggling with some debilitating symptoms. And people don't understand what living with Lyme is like. So we have to build community so that people can have conversations about what life with Lyme on a day-to-day basis is like. Many times people that are long-time sufferers with Lyme are very much isolated. They can't, especially our young adult population, they can't hold the types of jobs their peers have because they just don't have the energy or the physical stamina to work a traditional 9-10 hour day job. They may come out of school, may not be able to even participate in school. A lot of high school kids are homeschooled when chronic Lyme is at play because they just can't physically attend.
Wow.
And parents, caregivers, spouses really need that support so that they can talk to other people and understand what it's like when you are partnered with someone that can't work full time. So there's a huge financial burden on families. And trying to manage the care, the finances of the care, the household responsibilities with someone that may be bedbound, it's a lot of stress. So it's a mental health aspect, not only for the person suffering, but also for the, you know, the family members that have to radically adjust their lives in order to give the person who is in treatment what they need to feel supported.
Mm. So these Lyme and Lattes monthly meetups, are they happening right now?
They are. We've been meeting. I try to hold them at different locations across the state because very often people with Lyme aren't able to travel very far. And we have a blessing. Connecticut's a small state, but it does take about 2 hours to get across it. So I hold them around the state in different locations. And we average about 5 to 7 people each month that attend. And we have some regulars, which is amazing because then we get to really build relationships and friendships with the people that we see every month.
And you actually have an opportunity this May, which is Lyme Awareness Month, and we'll be having you on back, well, before that, but certainly during that month, where coffee shops can also step up to support the work that you're doing.
Yes, we are asking coffee shops to partner with us. Because we know how important they are. My daughter, coffee is actually medicine for her. One of her symptoms is chronic migraines.
Oh, wow.
And so when she has a migraine, a latte takes that migraine pain away. It always has. Just that caffeine helps her so much. So it was a natural outlet for us to start having our meetups in coffee shops. So we're asking coffee shops to design a drink for Lyme Awareness Month and market it, promote it in their shop, and donate the proceeds of that drink to Partner in Lyme. And right now we have Cash and Live in Sandy Hook, Newtown, that's on board. Frenchies in Stratford is on board with us. And we are literally going to various coffee shops around the state and asking them to partner with us this way because community is so important because the symptoms that people are really experiencing are severe and real and need to be made aware.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, if you want to learn more, you want to check out more of the resources available to you, apply for assistance, anything like that, go to partnerinlyme.org, all spelled out, partnerinlyme, L-Y-M-E, partnerinlyme.org. And Jessica, I want to thank you for the work that you do and for always making yourself available to come on WICC. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Again, Jessica Schneider, who is the founder and executive director for Partner in Lyme Incorporated, and that website is partnerinlyme.org. February is not just Black History Month. It's not just Heart Health Month, which are two things we've tackled in today's show. It also is Teen Dating Violence Awareness Month. And this is designed to really raise awareness about what a healthy relationship is and what it is not, and to help teens and young people identify unhealthy and abusive relationships. There are some statistics that might be very daunting for you, so I do want you to be aware before I read these out loud that it's very disturbing when you look at a snapshot of healthy and not healthy relationships in our nation. 1 in 3 U.S. teens will experience physical, sexual, or emotional abuse from someone they are in a relationship with before becoming an adult. About 1 in 12 high school students experience physical dating violence. About 1 in 12 high school students experience sexual dating violence. And about 1 in 4 teens are abused through technology. So when you hear all of that, you realize how important it is that we are advocating for healthier relationships and we are recognizing the signs of being in an abusive relationship. And so I want to talk to somebody who is all about teaching healthy relationships and modeling that and trying to combat the issue of domestic violence and unhealthy relationships. And that is Gary McNamara. He also happens to be one of our law enforcement experts on the show. He is the chief and executive director of public safety and government affairs at Sacred Heart University, which is also very focused on making sure that young people, especially college students, are engaging in healthy relationships. Gary, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for your time.
Of course, Melissa. Thank you, as always, for having me.
Of
talk
course.
About this stuff.
Yeah, it's not fun to talk about it. But you know what? When you hear those statistics, it's interesting to me, Gary. I was doing a little bit of research because I always like to see where these awareness months, when they pop up, the significance of them. It's only been around since 2010, which I think is amazing.
Right.
But I also think that paints a picture of the fact that we are talking about unhealthy relationships more. We're bringing more awareness to it. But also, I think it has become a cultural issue. I mean, 1 in 3 teens across the U.S. will experience basically an abusive relationship before they get to adulthood. That's astonishing.
Yeah. Yeah. And the other thing that it does is it also recognizes that we can paint a broad brush on domestic violence and violence against women, but you really, each relationship, there's categories of relationships. So teen dating has its own uniqueness to it. You know, violence is violence, but the relationship, the dynamics of any relationship is going to drive some of that violence.
You know,
dating is an important part.
Well, what's interesting too, Gary, is when you hear teens, people immediately think high school. But my understanding from Deb Greenwood is that we have seen a significant uptick in recent years of domestic violence or abuse happening in relationships on college campuses. There are teens who are also in college.
Sure. Yeah. And you can't look at it like, okay, this is just a high school thing. And then magically or mysteriously over the summer before they enter college, it all changes for them.
Mm-hmm.
No, I mean, the dynamics of those relationships don't change. They just change location. So, yeah, and there's teenagers, you know, basically when we think of teenagers, maybe 12 to 19, but yeah, there's teenagers coming in. And then that enters a whole new dynamic because they're going into a new location. Their base, their resources, their rocks in their life that have kept them together and kept them on the right path. And their sounding board for problems they have, a lot of them have gone away, and now they find themselves in a new position, making new friends, but also we try our best to make sure that they're still making the right choices and know that they have support here to have healthy relationships.
So Gary also has a connection to the Center for Family Justice, not just his role at Sacred Heart University, but also he advocates a lot for especially young men to step up and speak out when they recognize that something is abusive or is not okay, the way that people treat each other. So this is something that I know is very near and dear to your heart, Gary. Could you talk a little bit about what is done at the campus level? Like, what are some things, since you've been at Sacred Heart University, what are some things that the college is doing to address healthier relationships and just students treating each other, especially if they're romantically involved, better because of the statistics we're living in?
Yeah, I think that the first thing to do is to make sure that we have the resources for them. So RAs and the people that they greet and those individuals that are going to guide them at least through the first initial month or two and maybe even the first year, hopefully more than that, are aware of some of the signs and concerns and are available to hear concerns from any of our students. And so they're welcoming to hear those. In addition to that, we want to make sure that when information comes forward, that information is, they know what to do with it. And so we have a significant process in place where anyone who comes in contact or anyone who receives information of a potential, you know, violent relationship, there's an avenue for them to come forward. And those that aren't comfortable coming forward, we have an anonymous tip line where somebody, a group of friends may get together and say, hey, one of my friends is in a bad relationship and I think it's violent or I'm really concerned about her, and at least it can get it on the radar. And then once we get that information, we have a really strong counseling service and a lot of counselors over there that kind of get together. We all collectively get together and see what steps might be needed. In fact, if this person or people need resources.
We have Gary McNamara here from Sacred Heart University, and we're talking about February, which is Teen Dating Awareness, specifically Teen Dating Violence Awareness Month. And I want to know, Gary, what would be your suggestion? You know, when you talk to parents who are dropping off their kids at college for the first time, or when you talk to people who you want to advocate for these healthier relationships in our community, what are things that you suggest? What do you tell people?
First of all, no, you should be having it way beforehand, hopefully. You have to have an open conversation and really understand what resources are available, but also it's really important to know the signs. And, you know, domestic and teen violence is all about control. And so, you know, you have to kind of encourage your students to get involved with friends that you know that are supportive of each other, that understand some of those signs, that control when they meet someone and that individual starts to put them down. Or a big one is checking cell phones or emails.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the jealousy shows up. Are they angry? Do they begin to isolate you from family and friends? It's very difficult when they come to college because they want to branch out, so family might not hear from them as much.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to maintain that contact. You know, obviously physical hurting is a sign of it, possessiveness. But, you know, some of the simple things, like they just tell you what to do, what to wear, and where to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, those are pretty important.
I mean, and something else, Gary, that you know, kind of leads to my next question, which is it's pretty common, correct? It's pretty common that if you're somebody who is already displaying abusive behavior in a relationship or control, like you were saying, when you're a teen, that most likely a lot of times will turn out to sometimes be a domestic violence situation when they're older, correct?
That's right. Yeah. You'll either, you know, in those teen dating years can really propel you to a path to be a victim, in domestic violence in the future, or to be an offender, because you shape your opinion of what relationships are based upon those initial relationships. That's why we're doing the mentor program. That's why we're trying to engage teens. That's why the Delta Tau Delta fraternity up here on campus is so engaged in it, because we know we have to get to women and men. We have to get to the men who are dating our women and explain to them what healthy relationships are all about. And so it's not females versus males. It's everyone together has to understand that this is a healthy relationship and this is what's not a healthy relationship and this is what can happen.
And I mean, I think it's also realizing, too, we have Gary McNamara here from Sacred Heart. It's realizing there are two different types of people in that relationship that we need to be aware of. Certainly, like you said, people who become victim to domestic violence. So recognizing the signs of an unhealthy relationship, or really giving power to the feelings you're feeling internally when you think, I don't feel so good about this, or this doesn't make me feel loved, this makes me feel controlled. Really recognizing those and acting on that. But the other person, Gary, that it sounds like we want to be aware of is if you yourself have those traits of controlling somebody, or feeling like you need to physically harm someone or emotionally put them down because it will secure you in your relationship. I mean, those are also things that we need to recognize as early as possible, because if we can correct that and model what a healthy relationship looks like, we can avoid more domestic violence cases, which unfortunately we've seen a huge uptick, especially in recent years since the pandemic. So it's recognizing both of those people.
Yeah. You're absolutely right. From the offender side of things, we want to make sure that we tell our young men what healthy relationships are about and how to be a healthy male. And then from the female side of things, we also want to say these are some signs. If you're feeling it, you have to tell somebody, at least to kind of talk to somebody about it. The problem with these teen violence relationships, most of them don't last. Some do. But the problem is oftentimes the female teenagers in these relationships begin to feel unhealthy about themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And they begin to have eating disorders and all those other things down the line could potentially come from these relationships that are unhealthy and abusive and make them feel less than valuable. And
right.
And it's upon all of us to kind of keep ringing the bell and yelling that that healthy relationships are this, and if you're in something that's not this, then you need to find help to get out of it.
Yeah, and correcting a lot of social norms. I mean, you and I have talked about before how it's seen as sexy sometimes when a woman is an object. You know, like that's something that starts even in the middle school age, where it's like, oh, you're my property, you belong to me. That's sexy, to belong to a guy. That's what a lot of girls are being taught by society, not so much by teachers or mentors, certainly, but on social media or by, you know, entertainment. It could be the music industry, movies, but whatever. So it's also correcting things like that. It's not cool to be someone's property, male or female. It's not acceptable to talk to somebody the way that we sometimes feel is okay, to use condescending nature, because, oh, there's nothing like being controlled by someone. No, no, not healthy.
Yeah.
We need to recognize and point that out, certainly. And that can start as young as elementary and in middle school age, is just knowing that own self-respect and correcting some of those social norms. That's important, too. But I love what you said.
Yeah. And you want to stop, you know, they talk about breaking the cycle. You want to stop the cycle before it ever happens.
Yeah.
And if you can't stop the cycle, the quicker we can break the cycle, and we can break it quicker in teen dating situations than we can in domestic violence situations when they're married or older. So it's important that we stop it where we can and break it as soon as possible.
Agreed. Gary McNamara, thank you so much for coming on and talking about this topic with us. We really appreciate it. And I know you'll be back really soon.
You got it, Melissa. Always be well.
All right. Gary McNamara of Sacred Heart right here on WICC.
Fighting against injustice across Connecticut, Melissa in the Morning checks in with the Commission on Human Rights and Opportunities. Now on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
As you know, February is Black History Month. And did you know that the Commission on Human Rights and Opportunities was in fact founded to address discrimination against African Americans? As we've learned in the last few years, having the CHRO on the show every single week, it obviously is helping with many different populations across Connecticut and across the nation. So it goes beyond what the initial need was for in today's world. But it did start off with really addressing discrimination against African Americans. And so who better to chat with than the CHRO when we are recognizing February as Black History Month? And we welcome to the show for the first time Catherine Spain, who is a human rights attorney, legal division for Commission on Human Rights and Opportunities. Welcome to WICC. Catherine, how are you?
I'm great. Good morning, Melissa. So nice to be on. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's really great to have you here. And during such an important month as well, talk to us about the importance of Black history in America's history.
You know, you really can't overemphasize the importance of Black history and American history and the contributions of Black Americans. As you said, the Connecticut Commission on Human Rights and Opportunities was created in 1943, and it was called the Interracial Commission. So it was created, the CHRO, to address and oppose America's centuries-long subordination of African Americans. And thanks for leading with that, because it's so important.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in as you mentioned, actually, in one of the notes that I read from you, the CHRO was founded to address discrimination against African Americans. How long ago was that?
We had a different name, but we were the first state-based agency of this kind, and it was in 1943, originally called the Interracial Commission, so right in the name. You know, Connecticut was recognizing the problem of systemic subordination of people of color.
Wow, that's amazing. So obviously for decades and decades, this has been something that the CHRO has been focused on. And when we talk about it very often, when we have them on a weekly basis here on The Morning Show, talk about, if you don't mind, Catherine, in so many ways, we've really come a long way. Certainly, we have addressed a lot of issues that we've had, you know, generations ago in our nation, and we've improved. But still, there is implicit as well as unconscious bias that still exists today, correct? I mean, let's talk a little bit about what we're dealing with in today's times.
So true, Melissa. And I really appreciate, as do all my colleagues at the CHRO, the opportunity to be on your program and think about this, because I think we have made progress, but we can do better. Recently, I've been reading an amazing book by a brilliant writer. It's called Cast, The Origins of Our Discontents, and the journalist author is Isabel Wilkerson. She is a Pulitzer Prize-winning author, and she talks exactly about that unconscious implicit bias. What a great thing for us to focus on when we try to figure out how we can improve our society. She writes, Americans have been exposed to so many negative messages. They come down to us through history, you know, about African Americans, that 70 to 80% of white Americans hold an unconscious bias against Black Americans. So this isn't even something people are doing on purpose. And that's why I'm trying to just bring it up in these few minutes we have that, hey, let's try to question and examine how we're thinking and what our impressions might be. Even one-third of Black Americans, believe it or not, hold an anti-Black bias against themselves. So it's really important. In her book, Cast, which I know is a best-selling book, and a lot of your listeners might have heard of it or might have read it, she talks about how unconscious bias is shown to contribute to disparities in hiring and housing, in education and medical treatment. And Melissa, didn't I read that you had a time in your career when you were on a health beat? Isn't that right?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Wow. Look at you. Yes, I did. I when I worked in television, I was the health beat reporter at one time when I was working up in Vermont. Yes, at CBS.
Well, then you could probably really appreciate this. It's, I guess, in the world of healthcare, according to sociologists cited in Isabel Wilkerson's book, American Africans are granted fewer procedures and they have poorer quality healthcare than whites.
Yes. And one of the things that I remember focusing on a lot when I worked the health beat was the fact that, you know, that population also has less access to prenatal care, for example. They have a higher rate of issues going on during the pregnancy and certainly after having a child. And even the rate of how many moms die during childbirth is incredibly high, much higher than it should be in America, but certainly higher than those of Caucasian descent. It's pretty crazy, actually.
It's so shocking and true, and we can do better. The studies I looked at in, from her book also talk about physicians under-treating or denying pain medication to Black patients, so much so that it says the disparity is so severe that if African Americans as a group receive pain medication at levels beneath the thresholds established by the World Health Organization.
Wow. That's just so – it's wild that we even – have that. I mean, I know a lot of times when we talk to the Commission on Human Rights and Opportunities, it's wild that it's something that just seems to me as common based thinking. You know, when I talk about a man and a woman who do the exact same job and are showing the same performance level, why there's a wage gap, like, to me, that will never make sense. And when you talk about a mom and a mom who both want to have a healthy pregnancy and have a healthy baby and survive that birthing process, again, I can't believe that there's such a disparity with healthcare, for example, because of the color of somebody's skin. Like, it's wild to think that's where we've come far in some aspects as a nation, but the fact that those are very basic examples of how much disparity there still is among people based on their gender or the color of their skin, that's wild to me. It's crazy.
It's shocking. And I agree with everything you said. When you read Isabel Wilkerson, for me personally, she really helped me think about how there's this whole system set up by caste, by race, that's artificial. Mm-hmm. And the insignificant differences in the color of your skin, the texture of your hair, are just that, right? They're insignificant.
Right, exactly. It is wild. We have Catherine Spain here, who is a human rights attorney for the Commission on Human Rights and Opportunities, and we are recognizing Black History Month, which is the month of February, as you know. Tell me, Catherine, what are specific things that we could be doing to recognize Black History Month in Connecticut, and what is the CHRO focused on for this month?
Well, Melissa, Farmington, Connecticut used to be considered the Grand Central Station of the Underground Railroad, which is pretty incredible, helping people escape slavery. So you can check out the Farmington Freedom Trail Tour in Farmington. You can Google it, but it usually happens Saturday at 10 o'clock at the First Church of Christ on Main Street in Farmington. You can celebrate 3 centuries of Black strength, resilience, and accomplishment at New London's Black Heritage Trail. And, you know, the nation's first boarding school for young African-American women was founded by Prudence Crandall in Connecticut in 1833. And there is a Prudence Crandall Museum in Canterbury, so check that out. We've got a couple other specific things to mention. This year, the theme of Black History Month is the arts, and there are 2 special exhibits commemorating Black History Month at the Beinecke Library. That's on the campus of Yale at 121 Wall Street, and one of them is called Writing and Resistance, and the other is called Douglas Baldwin Harrington, and it celebrates Frederick Douglass, James Baldwin, and Ollie Harrington. And last, the Connecticut Sun, our state's great WNBA team, has announced that it has some activities to celebrate this month. They're going to release on YouTube a piece called My Hair, My Crown. And they're also celebrating Black Connecticut artists to kind of emphasize our theme. And I would just say, you know, a lot of great Black art is considered a protest. And again, you know, it took a lot of courage to go against the norms of the day and to change things for the better in this country. I'm thinking of what's called a protest novel, Richard Wright's Native Son, a protest song, Mississippi Goddamn by the inimitable Nina Simone. Check out the paintings of Jean-Michel Basquiat for inspiration. And just try to keep in mind that the civil rights movement in the 60s, you know, where people like Martin Luther King were jailed, it benefited all of us. It made our society better. It benefited women because we then had our own civil rights movement and gay people and disabled people. And the laws that, you know, were written to address the racial subjugation and try to counter those, they led to laws that protect other disadvantaged groups.
So, Catherine, you just mentioned a lot of great opportunities for people to recognize Black History Month here in Connecticut. Is there a place in particular you could find those list of events and places to go?
There is. It's not on the CHRO websites, but if you just Google Black History Month in Connecticut, I know I visited that site myself, so I can find it for you right now.
I love this. Live radio. This is what we do. We do research live in real time.
I love it. Yeah. Right? Visit CT. Visit CT, celebrating Black history in Connecticut. And you know what? It's being updated all the time. So And again, there's also, you might want to Google Yale, because that's where I found the stuff about the special exhibits at the Beinecke Rare Book Library. And it's just a joyful month. And I know some of my colleagues have talked before on the show about how it started. And it started as a week-long celebration, and now we have a month. And I'm just very grateful, you know, to know about this history.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you go to ctvisit.com and you search for Black History Month, you will find several different places you could go to get more of the details on some of the things Catherine just mentioned. And Catherine, I want to thank you so much for coming on WICC, recognizing Black History Month for the month of February, and really talking about also where the CHRO has played a role for a very long time and continues to do so even today. Thank you so much.
You can't thank you enough. Enjoy.
All right, Catherine Spain. Hope you'll be back sometime soon. We would love that. And we do talk to the CHRO every Monday here on WICC. And again, if you want to check out a list of events going on for Black History Month, check out ctvisit.com.